suggestions, inviting them to the White House for confidential conversations. As he drafted sections of his message, Roosevelt read them aloud to Hanna and the Big Four, appealing to them as valued mentors. He likewise included members of his cabinet in these sessions, inviting a frank discussion. The press described a very pretty scene, this young president sincerely and earnestly placing his thoughts before his older counselors and begging them to criticize wherein they thought he was wrong. Journalists noted in early November that Roosevelt had made more progress in the preparation of his message to Congress than any of his predecessors ever did so far in advance. This lengthy process allowed him to write the entire message personally, rather than simply compile sections submitted by various department heads, as was customary. As page after page accumulated, curiosity about the contents escalated. No subject attracted more interest than the trusts. Many scribes with many minds, writing for many papers, are guessing and philosophizing as to what the president's message will and will not contain, one paper remarked, concluding that the only real thing anybody can guess or predict about with an approximation to truth is that it will be Roosevelt's message and nobody else's. From the start, Roosevelt determined that he would not retreat one hair's breadth from the position on the trusts that he had established in his gubernatorial message, his vice presidential acceptance speech, and the address he had delivered at the Minnesota State Fair 5 days before McKinley was shot. "More and more it is evident," he had declared that day in Minneapolis, "that the state, and if necessary the nation, has got to possess the right of supervision and control as regards the great corporations." He had repeatedly emphasized the need for corporations to deliver public reports to the government on their capitalization, profits, and financial structures. Now he intended to highlight that recommendation in his annual message by calling for a cabinet-level Department of Commerce and Industries, an agency empowered to examine the workings of the big corporations. Orville Platt warned Roosevelt that if Congress passed a law going so far as to force corporations doing an interstate business to make reports to United States officials, it would likely be ruled unconstitutional. Hanna insisted that the proposition would only furnish ammunition to the enemy in a political contest, and that even the labor unions were not greatly interested in corporate control. Roosevelt held his ground, even after a contentious session with his friends George Perkins and Harvard classmate Robert Bacon, both of whom were partners in J.P. Morgan's firm. While he remained very fond of both men, Roosevelt found that they argued like attorneys for a bad case, and at the bottom of their hearts, each would know this if he were not the representative of a man so strong and dominant a character as Pierpont Morgan. Not only did they encourage the president to go back on his previous demands for disclosure, but Perkins apparently suggested that he do nothing at all and say nothing except platitudes. Accept the publication of what some particular company chooses to publish as a favor, instead of demanding what we think ought to be published from all companies as a right. As historian Eric Goldman observes, the practice of not prying into business affairs was accepted as part of a prevailing laissez-faire. Just as Abraham Lincoln would exorcise his frustrations in hot letters he would put aside unsent, Roosevelt confined his rancor to private diatribe and followed it with a public letter for Robinson to share with the two men. "I much enjoyed the visit from Perkins," he amiably wrote. "I am particularly desirous to see him and Bacon as often as possible." To Paul Dana, conservative editor of the New York Sun, Roosevelt spoke more directly. In mid-November, Dana wrote a long critical letter to Roosevelt admonishing that the proposition that the federal government should lay its hand on business corporations is revolutionary. It would open the door to an unlimited increase of the powers of the federal government. Adding to his argument, Dana insisted, "There is no authority of public opinion for the demand for trust legislation. I deny the political right of the Republican successor of President McKinley to undertake it." Roosevelt acknowledged his warnings, but had no intention of altering his course. "Your letter causes me concern," Roosevelt replied. "To ask me to alter my convictions as to the proper course to be pursued about these big corporations is much like asking me to alter my convictions about the Monroe Doctrine, and the need of building a navy. You have no conception of the revolt that would be caused if I did nothing. On the morning of December 3, 1901, Roosevelt's completed message, totaling more than 20,000 words, was carried to the House and the Senate to be read by a clerk, as had been the custom since Thomas Jefferson sent the message in writing. A hush immediately fell over the body as the clerk began in clear, firm, and distinct tones to read the opening paragraphs, the Washington Times reported, observing that he did not read in the usual sing-song monotone, but with emphasis and expression. The recitation took about 2 hours, but there was interest in every line, and members of both houses listened with unusual attention. The assembled legislators generally received such messages with scant courtesy, the Washington correspondent for the Chicago Record Herald noted, retiring to the allurement of the smoking room or restaurant. Today, they sat still. The message opened with an emotional denunciation of McKinley's assassin, a professed anarchist inflamed by the teachings of professed anarchists. Such men, who object to all governments, good and bad alike, only sabotaged progress, Roosevelt declared. This impassioned opening introduced Roosevelt's agenda of moderate, reasoned reform. His tempered approach towards curbing the abuses of industrialism, he asserted, would prove the surest way to combat the alarming rise of anarchism, socialism, and demagoguery. In the long sentences of Roosevelt's message, semicolons followed by yet or but separated clauses that balanced each side of an issue, reflecting Roosevelt's characteristic, on the one hand, on the other, style of crediting antagonistic views. The captains of industry, who have driven the railway system across the continent, who have built up our commerce, who have developed our manufactures, have, on the whole, done great good to our people, Roosevelt proclaimed. Yet, it remains true, there have been abuses connected with the accumulation of wealth. Repeatedly, he employed this rhetorical display of even-handedness. To strike with ignorant violence at the great trusts endangers the interests of all, and yet it is also true that practical efforts must be made to correct those evils. If he had no patience for those who resorted to hatred and fear to denounce the trusts, Roosevelt made it clear that he shared the widespread conviction that certain invidious practices were hurtful to the general welfare. While he stopped short of advocating prohibition of the trusts, he demanded that they be supervised and, within reasonable limits, controlled. Roosevelt's strategic deliberations provoked a stinging parody from Finley Dunn's Mr. Dooley. "The trusts," says Roosevelt, "are hideous monsters, built up by the enlightened enterprise of the men that have done so much to advance progress in our beloved country. On one hand, I would stamp them underfoot. On the other, not so fast." Although Roosevelt's carefully balanced propositions invited accusations of equivocation, the rhetoric of his message allowed him to set the stage for reform without immediately alienating corporate interests. Conservative critics, soothed by language touting the benefits of capitalism and condemning the populist call for the total destruction of the trusts, missed the true implications of Roosevelt's central argument concerning the federal government's responsibility to regulate corporations in the public interest. "It is no limitation upon property rights or freedom of contract," he wrote, "to require that when men receive from government the privilege of doing business under corporate form, they assume an obligation to the public. Through the creation of a new Department of Commerce, the government would merely exercise its duty to inspect and examine corporate finances as a means to determine whether regulation or taxation was necessary. Should Congress determine that it lacks the constitutional power to pass such an act, Roosevelt recommended that an amendment to the Constitution be submitted to confer that power." Immediate attention following his message focused on the trusts. Yet, Roosevelt had also outlined his plans for the welfare of wage workers, reciprocity agreements, railway rebates, forest preserves, irrigation of arid lands, and the Isthmian Canal, as well as his ideas for reorganizing the army and expanding the navy. At the close of his address, he returned to the tragedy of McKinley's death, acknowledging the expressions of sympathy and grief from every quarter of the civilized world that had touched the hearts of every American. Generally, both the public and the press received Roosevelt's address well. No other message in 10 years past has been read by so many American citizens, claimed the Independent. The tenor of the State of the Union was viewed as characteristic of the man, self-assertive, determined, honest, patriotic, permeated with the spirit of progress. Despite widespread approbation, however, newspapers remained skeptical of any important outcome from the president's recommendations regarding trusts. Convinced that Roosevelt's primary goal at this juncture was his own nomination and election. He knows very well that no man can secure the Republican nomination over the trusts, an Indiana paper editorialized. The trusts understood the proposals as mere theater to satisfy reformers. While it was refreshing to see a bold man struggling with the devilfish of party intrigue, until middle-class confusion about corporate consolidation galvanized a demand for positive action, conservative powers in Congress would have no trouble preventing Roosevelt's proposals from even reaching the floor. On February 19, 1902, Roosevelt staggered the financial world by announcing the government's intention to bring an antitrust suit against Northern Securities. This giant holding company had recently merged the rail and shipping lines of James Hill, J.P. Morgan, and Cornelius Vanderbilt in the Northwest with those of E.H. Harriman, the Rockefellers, and the Goulds in the Southwest. Consummated during Roosevelt's watch, this vast new combination, first reported at length by Ray Baker, touched a nerve in the president. Baker, who had worked for months on a series of articles profiling the nation's tycoons, was well positioned to cover the spectacular merger. He had returned to New York from his sojourn in Arizona, re-energized and eager to tackle the unsettling issues of labor and capital that had preoccupied him since his college days. He felt that he had come to see and know the workers' side as he covered the Pullman strike for the Chicago Record, conversing at length with Eugene Debs, and spending long weeks with a number of other labor leaders. I knew, or thought I knew, the powerful incentives for organization behind their movements, he wrote, and their demands for more wages and more freedom. Realizing he must also develop an understanding of the business and financial side, Baker was thrilled when McClure suggested a series focused on the captains of industry. While he did not consider these articles to be revolutionary or crusading, his research shaped an evolving conception of capitalism's dazzling strengths and troubling weaknesses. Baker's first article on J.P. Morgan, published in October of 1901, portrayed a Wall Street giant who controlled a yearly income and expenditure nearly as great as that of Imperial Germany, paid taxes on a debt greater than that of many of the lesser nations of Europe, and by employing 250,000 men, supported a population of over 1 million souls, almost a nation in itself. While Baker acknowledged that the powerful private banker was an expert financial doctor, who had rescued the American economy from panic on 3 separate occasions, he withheld judgment on whether Morgan had employed that unquestioned genius to the highest purpose. The alarming dimensions of Morgan's empire were delineated in a follow-up article that analyzed the structure of the United States Steel Corporation. This immense enterprise, the first billion-dollar corporation in the world, had been conceived the previous April when J.P. Morgan, Andrew Carnegie, and the leaders of 9 other steel companies merged to avoid a ruinous competitive war. Many of these men, Baker concluded, were unquestionably forced into consolidation against their will. The resulting corporation produced more than a quarter of the entire steel production of the world, and dictated the destinies of a population nearly as large as that of Maryland or Nebraska. To enumerate its corporate possessions glazes the mind. More than 18,000 coke ovens, 80 blast furnaces, 6 giant railroad companies, and 115 steamships. It is difficult to convey any adequate idea of the magnitude of the Steel Corporation, Baker concluded. Nothing like this has ever been seen before. Baker's research for these 2 articles on J.P. Morgan provided clear perspective on the machinations behind the formation of Northern Securities. The merger, Baker explained, stemmed from a costly quarrel the previous spring. Two rival railroads that controlled the overwhelming majority of railroad lines in their respective regions had fought for control of a third railroad. In the aftermath, under the leadership of J.P. Morgan, the contestants gathered themselves together, counted their losses, smoothed over their difficulties, and forged a gargantuan new holding company. On November 13, 1901, Northern Securities became the second largest corporation in the world, behind only U.S. Steel. With tens of thousands of miles of track spanning the continent and hundreds of ships, Baker declared it absolute dictator in its own territory, with monarchical powers in all matters relating to transportation. None outside the Golden Coterie know all the details, Baker observed, presciently adding, "The future will find one of its great problems is deciding how big a business enterprise must become before the public is entitled to know the full details of its management." It appeared certain, however, that the same dozen or more men would own nearly all the great railroads of America and the greatest industries besides. Indeed, with this new combination in place, a person might journey from England to China on regular lines of steamships and railroads without once passing from the protecting hollow of Mr. Morgan's hand. Would the day come, Baker mused, when an imperial M would repose within the wreath of power? The implication that these few men were more powerful than the people, more powerful than Congress, more powerful than the government, observed Mark Sullivan, presented to Roosevelt a challenge such as his nature would never ignore. Roosevelt asked his Attorney General, Philander C. Knox, if an antitrust suit against Northern Securities could be sustained. A brilliant lawyer who had enjoyed a successful career in Pittsburgh, Knox calculated the odds for several weeks before reporting to Roosevelt that he believed an antitrust suit based on the Sherman antitrust law could be won. Roosevelt kept his decision to proceed from everyone else in his cabinet, including Elihu Root, his closest advisor. Root did not share the view that Taft and I take about corporations, he later explained to a journalist friend. The unexpected announcement that the government was in the process of preparing a bill to test the validity of the merger appeared like a thunderbolt from a clear sky. Many commentators feared the outbreak of a wholesale war on industrial trusts. Not since the assassination of President McKinley has the securities market been compelled to face news for which it was wholly unprepared, declared the New York Herald, under headlines announcing a precipitous fall in stock prices. Financiers could not fathom how Roosevelt lacked the courtesy to provide advance notice. He was, after all, one of them, a Harvard man, a member of their clubs. "If we have done anything wrong," J.P. Morgan complained in a hastily arranged meeting with the president 3 days later, "send your man to my man and they can fix it up." An agreeable resolution was impossible, Roosevelt countered. "We don't want to fix it up," Knox confirmed. "We want to stop it." Turning to Roosevelt, Morgan inquired if U.S. Steel was in jeopardy. "Certainly not," Roosevelt replied, "unless we find out that in any case they have done something that we regard as wrong." Roosevelt remarked to Knox after Morgan's departure, "That is a most illuminating illustration of the Wall Street point of view. Mr. Morgan could not help regarding me as a big rival operator." Morgan's partners were appalled at the lack of recognition for their substantial contribution to American progress. "It really seems hard," James Hill complained, "that we should be compelled to fight for our lives against the political adventurers who have never done anything but pose and draw a salary." Members of New York's legal community were scathing in their opinion of Knox, calling him an unknown country lawyer from Pennsylvania. When these words reached Roosevelt, his response was curt: "They will know this country lawyer before this suit is ended." For a quarter of a century, Roosevelt later observed, the power of the mighty industrial overlords of the country had increased with giant strides, while the methods of controlling them or checking abuses by them on the part of the people through the government remained archaic and therefore practically impotent. The antitrust suit served notice on everybody that it was going to be the government and not the Harrimans who governed these United States. At the same time, Roosevelt's actions clearly demonstrated to powerful Republican leaders that he was president in fact as well as in name. Roosevelt next turned his attention to the Beef Trust. Allegations had surfaced in the press that the big beef packers, led by Armour & Company and Swift & Company, had agreed to parcel out territories and fix prices, resulting in a sharp cost increase for families purchasing meat. The advent of refrigerated freight cars had diminished the advantage once held by local butchers, facilitating consolidation among the big national firms. Labeling the Beef Trust an atrocious conspiracy of greed against need, one New York newspaper challenged anyone to deny that such absolute control by a few men over the food supply of a nation is in the highest degree hostile to the public welfare. After the Justice Department investigated the matter, Roosevelt directed Knox to bring suit against the Beef Trust. "This is the right course," the World editorialized, "and the president has proved himself, as he did in directing the similar suit against Northern Securities Company, to be wiser and more resolute than leaders of his party in Congress, who sit supinely in the path of a rising storm of popular indignation and refuse to do anything to disturb the business of protecting monopolies by law." For all the accolades that attended his confrontations with these massive combinations, Roosevelt considered the Sherman Act a blunt instrument that might prove more dangerous to the patient than the disease. In the hands of zealots, unable or unwilling to distinguish good trusts that yielded efficient operations, lower prices, and better service, from bad trusts that used predatory tactics to gain monopoly, artificially depress production, and extort unreasonable prices, the Sherman Act might destroy the very prosperity it was intended to foster. Roosevelt far preferred the approach recommended in his annual address: new legislation enabling the national government to examine corporate records and determine what remedies, if any, were needed. Nevertheless, with the path to effective regulation blocked by a stubborn, conservative Congress, historian George Murray observes, the only way for Roosevelt to bring the arrogant capitalists to heel was through the judicious use of the antitrust laws. For Nellie and Will Taft, the winter of Roosevelt's skirmishes with the trusts marked a period of bereavement and protracted illnesses. During the long sea voyage from Manila to San Francisco, doctors discovered that Taft's incision was not healing properly. It was opened and drained, but months of bed rest the previous fall had weakened his knees and ankles, making it painful for him to stand for any protracted time. To compound matters, Nellie was suffering from what was later diagnosed as malaria. In San Francisco, they were informed that their cross-country trip on the Union Pacific would be interrupted by a severe snowstorm in the Midwest. Having received word that her mother was seriously ill, Nellie insisted on moving forward nonetheless. In Utah, a catastrophic blizzard froze water pipes and broke the train's heating system. Wrapped in blankets, they pressed eastward. Even after enduring these hardships, they were too late. In Omaha, Nellie received a telegram bearing the news that her mother had died the previous day. Taft remained with Nellie and the children in Cincinnati until he had to leave for Washington to testify before the Senate Committee on the Philippines. From the moment he arrived in the Capitol, Taft was surrounded by affectionate support. War Secretary Elihu Root and his wife insisted that he board with them during his stay, which eventually stretched to 30 days. No sooner had Taft reached their home on Rhode Island Avenue than the president called with plans to join them that evening. Taft was pleased to find Roosevelt just the same as ever, writing to Nellie that it was hard to realize that he is the president. He greatly enjoys being president, and shows not the slightest sign of worry or hard work in his looks or manner. Scarcely a night passed for Taft without an invitation to dine with the Roosevelts, the Lodges, the Hayes, or the Hannas. Despite his warm reception in Washington, Taft worried about the hearings. Called by Massachusetts Senator Hoar, an eloquent anti-imperialist who insisted on exposing the truth of events in the Philippines, the proceedings would likely be exhausting and unproductive. "If General Chafee is right," Hoar proclaimed, "there is not a man in those islands who is not conspiring against the government and eager for liberty." The day before the hearings convened, Taft wrote to his brother Horace, playfully requesting compassion and merciful judgment when you shall read of the condemnation to which I shall probably be subjected by anti-imperialists and our democratic brethren. Please do not deny the fact that you are still my brother, though a mortified one. Throughout a long week of testimony, however, Taft acquitted himself exceedingly well, drawing a sharp line between the military's negative estimates of the Filipino people and his own more hopeful perspective. I have much more confidence in the Filipino and his loyalty than have a good many of the military officers, he assured them. Asked by Democratic Senator Joseph Rawlins if the country was not flying in the face of Asiatic culture and tradition by imposing a Republican form of government, he expressed his conviction that such difficulties could be successfully negotiated. In the course of his governorship, Taft said, he had developed somewhat intimate relations with the Filipino people and was certain that the overwhelming majority wanted peace and a stable government. Taft told the committee, as he had told McKinley, that he had not supported the idea of occupying the Philippines. But we are there. America's primary responsibility, he maintained, must be to help the Filipinos achieve self-rule, slowly inducting them into the political process. Eventually, a determination would be possible regarding the future of the Philippines, whether they should apply for statehood, declare full independence, or perhaps develop a commonwealth connection to the United States, similar to that of Canada or Australia, to Great Britain. He called on Congress to reduce the tariff on Philippine imports, and to establish a popularly elected assembly to constitute a lower branch of the government, while the commission continued to comprise the upper branch. Taft understood that some senators considered this policy too progressive and too radical, but believed it would provide a great educational school in the art of democracy. When pressed about instances of military brutality against the Philippine insurgents, he admitted that cruelties have been inflicted, that people have been shot when they ought not to have been, and that soldiers had employed water torture to extract information from insurgents. Courts-martial had been ordered to address these abuses. He insisted, however, that the military had largely exercised uncommon compassion and restraint. Following his appearance, one reporter noted, not a speaker on either side but paused a moment to pay at least some small tribute to the man. By speaking freely and openly, Taft had taken his fellow citizens into his confidence on the dangers and the doubtful points of our experiment, as well as on its rosier aspects. In return, he had earned their confidence in his sincerity and in his ability to meet the task in hand. Extremely pleased, Elihu Root assured Taft that if he continued his great service to the Philippines for another year or more, there was not anything in the gift of the president that would be withheld. The pleasure of Taft's stay in Washington was cut short when doctors determined that yet another operation was required to remove a deep abscess that had developed in the aftermath of his previous surgery. News that he would be confined to his bed for 3 weeks left him feeling downcast. I have been hacked and cut and curated and etherized so much, and have lain so long in bed, that a continuance of all this for the better part of a month I do not welcome, and should deeply regret if it delayed my return. Nonetheless, he submitted gamely to a third operation in 6 months, and this time, happily, recorded that the cure seems to be complete. Contemplating his return to the Philippines, Taft decided to stop first in Rome, where he hoped personally to negotiate some solution to the perplexing problem of the Spanish friars, a situation that had plagued him from his first days in the islands. To the Filipino people, Taft understood, the friars represented the crown of Spain, and every oppression by the Spanish government was traced by them to the men whose political power had far outgrown that exercised by them as priests. Over the years, these clerics had come to operate as political bosses, acquiring 400,000 acres of the best agricultural lands and assuming despotic power over the police, the civil government, and the schools. Once the revolution began, he wrote, they had to flee for their lives. 50 of them were killed and 300 of them were imprisoned. If they should return and attempt to reclaim title to the land, he feared violence would break out. Roosevelt and Root deputized Taft to inform the Holy See that the United States would purchase the lands for a fair price so long as the hated friars never returned to the archipelago. The land would then be redistributed among the poor Filipino farmers. "What a splendid thing it would be to go to Rome," Nellie exclaimed when she learned of her husband's strategic mission. In the weeks before the planned trip, Nellie's health had improved. Blood tests revealed a reduction in her malarial infection, and her spleen had returned to normal. Yet just before they were scheduled to sail, Robert contracted scarlet fever, making departure impossible for Nellie and the children. "What a disarrangement of our plans," Taft lamented. "And more than this, what a trial for Robert and you." Louise Taft was in Millbury, Massachusetts, when Will called to explain her grandson's illness and to bid her goodbye. Realizing that Nellie could not travel, Louise offered to accompany her son. Despite her own disappointment, Nellie was relieved that Will would have the comfort and assistance of his mother during the trip. Within 24 hours, Nellie recalled, the intrepid old lady of 74 packed her trunks and was in New York ready to sail. In the years since Alfonso's death, Louise had astonished her family with her unflagging activity. She went wherever she liked, Nellie noted with admiration, and it never seemed to occur to her that it was unusual for a woman of her age to travel everywhere with so much self-reliance. Until Nellie arrived in Rome with the children more than a month later, Louise managed affairs with an energy and an enterprise that overwhelmed her son with pleasure and pride. Several factors complicated Taft's mission. He had to take care throughout the process that his dealings with the Pope never implied diplomatic recognition, which would violate America's separation of church and state and incur the hostility of Protestants. At the same time, he sought to diffuse Catholic fears that he was antagonistic to the church. His initial meeting with the Pope, still lively as a cricket and bubbling with humor at 82, went better than he could have hoped. Most significantly, Taft noted, he secured the pontiff's promise to meet all questions in a broad spirit of conciliation, though the details were left to a group of cardinals who proved far less accommodating. Weeks went by before the cardinals finally issued a statement on June 21, 1902. The church would consent to sell its property in the Philippines, but would not withdraw the friars currently in residence. With this unsatisfactory conclusion, negotiations were suspended. When Taft at last prepared to sail for the Philippines, word arrived that a cholera epidemic had struck Manila. He decided Nellie and the children should remain in Europe for an additional month, hoping by then the outbreak would have run its course. Writing to Nellie from the steamer, he confessed feeling apprehensive about his reception in Manila. "I don't know how the people will take the result of my visit to Rome. Then they are not in very good humor about the strict cholera regulations. I may land with a few handshakings and a dull thud." He regretted her absence, but trusted she would soon join him and her indispensable support would help him surmount all difficulties. "I cannot tell you what a comfort it is to me to think of you as my wife and helpmeet," he declared. "I measure every woman I meet with you, and they are all found wanting. Your character, your independence, your straight mode of thinking, your quiet planning, your loyalty, your sympathy when I call for it, as I do too readily, your affection and love, for I know I have it. All these, darling, make me happy only to think about them." To his amazement, Taft's arrival triggered the grandest demonstration of popular support ever recorded in the history of the Philippines. 30,000 Filipinos had come from the hills and neighboring provinces to welcome Taft home. Whistles sounded and bells rang as soon as his vessel was spied. From the harbor to the palace, his carriage was met by cheering crowds. Triumphal arches and flags decorated the streets. Children tossed flowers and released doves into the air as Taft went by. In his speech at the palace, Taft told the people in a straightforward way of his experiences in Washington and Rome. Though negotiations with the Vatican had been suspended, the sale of church lands to the government was assured, and he was confident that an agreement to remove the friars would eventually be worked out. Taft took comfort that the natives had clearly interpreted his visit to Rome as a real effort on the part of the United States to do something which could not have been for any other benefit than the benefit of the Filipino people. Visibly moved, he promised to work unremittingly for the people of the islands. So universal, earnest, and enthusiastic was the response, reporters noted, that it left no doubt that Taft had earned a proud position in the hearts of the Filipino people. Back in the United States, Taft's visit to Rome met with less enthusiasm. "I am in the worst hole politically I have ever been in my life," Roosevelt confided to his newspaper friend Colsat. "The whole Catholic Church is on my back." Though every intelligence from the Philippines established what a lecherous lot of scoundrels the Spanish friars are, Roosevelt privately railed, Catholics maintained that these reports were simply propaganda to establish Protestant missions in the Philippines. If such calumnies did not cease, the president was cautioned, Catholics would join en masse to thwart his nomination in 2 years' time. "As things have turned out, it has probably been unfortunate that we got you to stop at Rome," Roosevelt wrote Taft, lamenting that the Catholic uproar had rather complicated the political situation at home. Perhaps, he suggested, they should let this whole matter go and simply administer the civil government, leaving the friars and other ecclesiastical bodies to get along as best they can. Taft responded vehemently. "While the result of the visit to Rome may have been bad in the United States," he told Roosevelt, "I do not state it too strongly when I say that the visit to Rome has done us a great deal of good in this country." Taft's letter persuaded Roosevelt to continue talks with the Vatican, which eventually produced an agreement. The United States paid $7.5 million for the lands, which were divided into small parcels and sold to natives, creating a new landowning class. Though the Spanish friars were never formally withdrawn, their power dwindled with the appointment of priests and bishops from other countries. Under Taft's deliberate leadership, a solution had been found that eased tensions and, in the end, finally satisfied the islanders, the administration, and the Catholic Church alike. On July 1, 1902, Speaker Henderson delivered a rousing speech to his colleagues, flattering them before they adjourned that no House of Representatives since the adoption of the Constitution had done so much work as this one. The Speaker's laudatory words touched a responsive chord among the members, who saluted both their Speaker and themselves with unrestrained emotion. While the cheering and applause were still in progress, one reporter noted, the members on the floor began singing "My Country, 'Tis of Thee." It was taken up by the correspondents in the press gallery, and soon the vast hall was ringing as spectators joined in for the Star-Spangled Banner and other patriotic tunes. The mood of jubilation culminated when General Charles Hooker of Mississippi, a Confederate veteran who had lost his arm in the war, took his place by the side of the speaker, and together they sang Dixie. Roosevelt's assessment of the work done by the 57th Congress was far less sanguine. Nevertheless, he was delighted by the passage of the bill providing $170 million to acquire land and begin construction of the Panama Canal. "By far the most important action I took in foreign affairs during the time I was president," he later reflected, related to the Panama Canal. He also took a keen personal pride in the Newlands Reclamation Act, which set aside revenue from the sale of Western public lands into a national fund for the construction of dams and irrigation projects. The act was structured to enable small farmers to settle previously arid lands. "I regard the irrigation business as one of the great features of my administration," he remarked at the time. Congress also appropriated more than $500,000 for badly needed renovations to the White House. Despite its 31 rooms, the mansion did not provide comfortable living quarters for a family, especially a large one like the Roosevelts. The entire first floor, except for the family dining room, was used for state functions. The second floor was divided between a private wing and executive offices, including the president's office, the cabinet room, and the telegraph room. The family quarters consisted of only 5 bedrooms and lacked both closet space and sufficient bathroom facilities. The kitchen was outmoded, and the floors throughout trembled when one walked on them. Previous presidents had failed to persuade Congress that a thorough renovation was necessary. "The Roosevelts alone," Sylvia Morris writes, had the determination, in spite of criticism, to forge ahead with the long-overdue changes. The plans, drawn up by architect Charles McKim, called for the construction of a new West Wing office building connected to the main house by a colonnade, freeing up the old second-floor spaces for conversion into extra bedrooms, bathrooms, and sitting rooms, as well as a boudoir, a library, and a den. The demolition and major renovations were scheduled during the summer months, allowing Edith and the children to escape to Oyster Bay. Roosevelt had originally planned to remain in the White House, but was finally persuaded to move into a large townhouse on Lafayette Square. Despite his satisfaction with the Canal Bill, the Reclamation Act, and the successful appropriations for the White House renovation project, Roosevelt was sorely disappointed by the failure of Congress to take action on the signal economic issue of the day, the trusts. The call to establish a Department of Commerce with the power to demand information and determine necessary regulation of corporate trusts had been at the center of Roosevelt's first annual message. While the bill was debated at the committee level, Republican opposition prevented any real progress. Meanwhile, the Democratic attack on the trusts gathered momentum, heightening Roosevelt's anxiety that Republicans would pay at the polls for their failure to address the issue. The Republican majority had likewise failed to undertake the administration's requests for legislation on the Philippines that would reduce the tariff and institute a popular assembly. "I see in the opposition to the Philippine measure," Taft later complained to Roosevelt, "the fine Italian hand of our dear friend Aldrich of Rhode Island. Whenever there is anything which is likely to injure the tobacco, sugar, or silver mining interests under the so-called trust arrangements, that very able and deft manager of the Senate appears long enough in Washington to disturb the even tenor of projected remedial legislation." Senators obligated to the Sugar Trust also managed to kill a reciprocity bill designed to reduce the tariffs on Cuban exports, including raw sugar, by 20%. The reduction of duties, Roosevelt argued in a special message, would boost the young republic's economy and simultaneously open Cuba's markets to the United States. "I ask that the Cubans be given all possible chance to use to the best advantage the freedom of which Americans have such right to be proud," he exhorted, "and for which so many American lives have been sacrificed." Despite Roosevelt's plea, no action was taken. "Their conduct will return to plague them later," Joseph Bishop predicted. With the adjournment of Congress, Roosevelt headed to Oyster Bay for a 6-week vacation with his family, before launching a campaign swing to generate popular enthusiasm for Republicans in the upcoming midterm elections. The failure of the Republican Congress to take action on corporate regulation and reciprocity issues had furnished Democrats with powerful proof, despite Roosevelt's antitrust initiatives, that the Republican Party was in alliance with the trusts and with all the great monopolies of every description which are preying upon the country. By appealing directly to the people and lending his personal prestige to the fight for trust regulation, Roosevelt hoped to save his party from defeat in November. Traveling by train and open carriage, accompanied by dozens of reporters, Roosevelt opened his campaign in New England. In each of the 6 states, he delivered speeches focused predominantly on the trust issue, emphasizing the distinction between his own reasonable call for oversight of federal regulation of trusts and the Democratic crusade to eradicate all trusts in a manner that would destroy all our prosperity. He understood that many looked back with nostalgia on the pre-industrial era, when the average man lived more to himself, when the average community was more self-dependent, and when the gap between rich and poor was less glaring. He conceded that cities could never provide the same sense of common underlying brotherhood as country living, but argued that the modern industrial society had substantially raised the standard of comfort for most people. Efforts to turn backward he considered not only futile, but also wrong-headed. Lending a sympathetic ear to the unfocused discontent he encountered, Roosevelt forged a powerful connection with his audience, and then hammered home his core message. The national government must assume full power over the giant trusts, and that power must be exercised with moderation and self-restraint. From Rhode Island, Connecticut, and Massachusetts to Vermont, New Hampshire, and Maine, Roosevelt was met with overwhelming fervor. The booming of cannon, the clanging of church bells, the tooting of whistles, the braying of brass bands, and the cheering of thousands marked his progress. When he delivered his prepared speeches in the major cities, factories shut down, stores put up their shutters, flags were hoisted, and the people were out in their holiday clothes. There was not a single moment, observed reporters, when the streets were not crowded and people were not cheering themselves hoarse. As the train moved from city to city, thousands gathered at local railroad stations to glimpse their vibrant young president. Indeed, it seemed to one journalist that small towns turned out their entire population. The heady atmosphere of Roosevelt's tour abruptly ceased on the final day of his New England campaign when a speeding trolley car crashed headlong into the open carriage carrying Roosevelt and his party from Pittsfield, Massachusetts to Stockbridge. The impact overturned the carriage and hurled its occupants to the ground. The president, his private secretary George Cortelyou, and Governor Crane of Massachusetts were thrown clear of the wreck, but Roosevelt's favorite Secret Service agent, William Craig, was caught under the wheels of the rushing trolley car and torn apart. "It was a dreadful thing," Roosevelt grimly observed. "The car was coming at such a terrific speed that I felt sure all in the carriage would be killed." The crowd hastened toward the spot where Roosevelt lay, but despite a blackened eye and deep bruises on his jaw and leg, he insisted that he required no help. "I'm all right," he said. "Some of the others are badly hurt. Look after them." When he saw the body of his loyal guard, he dropped on his knee. "Poor Craig," he muttered over and over. "Too bad, too bad." Still, he insisted that his tour through Stockbridge, Great Barrington, and Bridgeport, Connecticut, should proceed. Seated in a new carriage, he gave the mounted guards somber instructions. "Gallop ahead, tell the people everywhere along the line that Craig has been killed and I wish no cheering." Edith rushed to meet her husband at Bridgeport and take him back to Oyster Bay, where he remained for only one day before departing on a week-long campaign swing through Tennessee, West Virginia, and North Carolina. Returning to Sagamore Hill, Roosevelt convened a memorable conference with Senators Aldrich, Spooner, Hanna, Allison, and Lodge to resolve how the president should handle the divisive issue of tariffs during his upcoming Western tour. The Republican establishment viewed the high Dingley tariff, passed during McKinley's first administration, as sacrosanct, the key to the country's economic prosperity. Yet in recent years, sharply rising consumer prices had produced growing demand for downward revision of the tariff. Capitalizing on this discontent, Democrats argued that high tariffs not only inflated prices, but effectively sustained the hated trusts. The destruction of both trusts and tariffs would be the rallying cry of their fall campaign. Complicating matters further, the tariff issue threatened to divide the president's own party between Western Republicans, who clamored for relief from the highest tariff in history, and Eastern manufacturers, who insisted on continued protection. At a state convention in the Republican stronghold of Iowa, a resolution had passed that linked tariffs to trusts and called for the elimination of tariffs on any product manufactured by a monopolistic trust. "The tariff must be revised, for it is barbarous, extortionate, damnable," Chicago Record Herald journalist Walter Wellman wrote to Roosevelt, insisting, "I want to see you take the lead. It is the biggest work to be done in the country today." Should Republicans launch the fall campaign without lowering the tariff, he warned, "hell will be to pay." Though Roosevelt found this point of view congenial, he also recognized the dynamite in tariff reduction. Tinkering with tariff policy might well produce a panic or something approaching to it, with consequent disaster to the business community and, incidentally, to the Republican Party. Moreover, Senators Aldrich and Hanna made it clear that if a reciprocity treaty could not pass the protectionist Senate, more general tariff revision had absolutely no chance of success. "As long as I remain in the Senate and can raise a hand to stop you," Mark Hanna pointedly told him, "you will never touch a schedule of the Tariff Act." Bowing to reality, Roosevelt promised the senators gathered at Oyster Bay that he would make no attempt to revise the tariff at the coming session of Congress, though he would continue to speak out about the trusts. "I do not wish to split my own party wide open on the tariff question," Roosevelt conceded, "unless some good is to come." The implications of Roosevelt's retreat on this issue would be far-reaching. Certain that he carried an unwelcome tariff message to Western audiences, Roosevelt anticipated a 3 weeks nerve-shattering trip. He soldiered on from Cincinnati to Detroit, to Logansport, Indiana, where the sentiment for downward revision of the tariff was particularly strong. The president's references to the tariff, the New York Times editorialized, sound like that of a man treading a path selected for him by others, not chosen by himself, and pursued only because the situation seemed to require it. His words were absorbed by crowds in comparative silence, after the noisy acclaim that had greeted his earlier speeches. "There are a good many worse things than the possibility of trolley car accidents in these trips," Roosevelt darkly quipped. Unfortunately, the injuries he sustained in the collision proved far more agonizing than tariff complications. He had tried to ignore the continued pain in his leg, but was noticeably limping by the time he reached Logansport. A visit to the hospital revealed a threatening abscess that required immediate surgery. The abscess was lanced, and a miniature pump attached to drain the bloody serum. Refusing anesthesia, Roosevelt climbed onto the operating table and turned to the doctors with a smile. "Gentlemen, you are formal. I see you have your gloves on." The surgeon jested in answer, "It is always in order to wear gloves at a president's reception." If Roosevelt muttered in pain under his breath a few times during the procedure, he reportedly said nothing that was distinct except to ask for a glass of water before the needle was removed. Carried out on a stretcher, Roosevelt received strict orders to stay off his leg for several weeks, forcing cancellation of his remaining campaign itinerary. As renovations to the executive mansion were still not complete, he was taken to the temporary White House at Lafayette Square. "Tell it not in Gath, but really I have enjoyed this 9 days' seclusion," he told Senator Orville Platt the following week. "I see Mrs. Roosevelt all the time, as she has come on here to take care of me. I read everything from Pendennis and Our Mutual Friend down to the last study of European interests in Asia. I do not have to see the innumerable people whom there is no object in seeing, but whom I would have to see if I were not confined to my room with my leg up, and I am able to do all the important work." Capitalizing on his enforced leisure, Roosevelt appealed to Herbert Putnam, the Librarian of Congress, for books that would feed his wildly eclectic intellectual appetites. A history of Poland, or something on early Mediterranean races. "Exactly the books I wished," he told Putnam several days later. "I am now reveling in Maspero and occasionally making a deviation into Sergius's theories about the Mediterranean races. It has been such a delight to drop everything useful, everything that referred to my duty, everything, for instance, relating to the coal strike and the tariff, or the trusts, or my power to send troops into the mining districts, or my duty as regards summoning Congress, and to spend an afternoon in reading about the relations between Assyria and Egypt, which could not possibly do me any good, and in which I reveled accordingly." By early October 1902, the coal strike to which Roosevelt referred had become the most formidable industrial deadlock in the history of the United States. The previous spring, more than 140,000 anthracite coal miners had gone on strike in Pennsylvania to protest low wages, harsh working conditions, and long hours. While the 5-month-old strike had caused no serious problems during the hot summer months, panic was settling in as cold weather approached. Coal was then the chief fuel source for heating homes, schools, and businesses. By September's end, schools in the Northeast began closing due to the shortage. Hospitals and government buildings were threatening to shut their doors. Confrontations in the coal fields were becoming increasingly violent, and mobs commandeered coal cars as they trundled through villages and small towns. An all-out social war seemed imminent. John Mitchell, the charismatic president of the United Mine Workers, believed that if the American people could truly see the sorrows and the heartaches of those who spend their lives in the coal mines, they would sympathize with the strikers' decision to stop work. To the average magazine or newspaper reader, however, the lives of those who delve in the bowels of the earth, removed from the sight of their fellow beings, remained as darkly hidden as the work itself, while the hardships generated by their strike were too immediately apparent. Some years earlier, Sam McClure had tried to expose the suffering of the industry's workers, commissioning realist author Stephen Crane to write a piece entitled In the Depths of a Coal Mine. Crane described a sinister system that brought children, yet at the spanking period, into the mines as breaker boys. There they worked 10 hours each day, separating out pieces of slate and other impurities from streams of coal speeding by on conveyor belts. Earning 55 cents a day, a breaker boy rarely set foot in a schoolhouse. His highest ambition was to rise to door boy, then mule boy, laborer, miner's helper, and finally full-fledged miner. If he reached that zenith, having survived the gas, the floods, the squeezes of falling rocks, the cars shooting through little tunnels, the precarious elevators, and the peculiar miner's lung disease, he started on the descent, going back to become a miner's helper, then a mine laborer, now a door boy, and when old and decrepit, he finally returns to the breaker, where he started as a child. In most collieries, mining families were forced to rent their shacks from the company and buy their food, clothing, and supplies from the company store, invariably at higher costs than outside the compound. It was a proverbial saying, children were brought into the world by the company doctor, lived in the company house or hut, were nurtured by the company store, baptized by the company parson, buried in a company coffin, and laid away in the company graveyard. Since mine owners generally paid employees in company-printed scrip instead of cash, workers had little recourse but to pay the exorbitant prices the company demanded. Just such conditions led to the founding of the United Mine Workers Union in 1890. The wave of consolidation that created trusts in steel, oil, and beef had produced a massive coal trust during the same period. The process of combination had begun when coal-carrying railroads began purchasing coal fields. Quickly, they utilized their control over freight rates to destroy independent coal operators, reaping the reward of monopolistic power over both production and transportation. While mine owners and operators of earlier eras had lived near the coal fields, gathering some understanding of the miners' situation, the railroad presidents and financiers who now controlled the industry shared no personal connection with their workers. Skilled in high finance, they had little experience with labor unions and scant comprehension of public relations. In the months preceding the strike, the miners had agreed to accept a 5% wage increase, a raise which would have amounted to $3 million annually against the operators' estimated profit of $75 million. The operators, represented by George Bear of the Philadelphia and Reading Railroad, flatly refused, confident that public opinion would drive the strikers back to work, crushing the union and Mitchell in the process. The operators badly miscalculated. As the strike entered its fifth month, opinion had turned in favor of the miners, largely due to the contrasting public impressions of Mitchell and Bear. In early August, Lincoln Steffens had drawn a profile of the compelling young UMW president for McClure's. A telling anecdote in his article illustrated the near mystical hold Mitchell exercised over the miners, many of them immigrants who barely spoke English. When President McKinley was shot and the news spread to the coal region, the workmen gathered into a mob crying, "Who shot our president?" They dispersed when they learned that it wasn't President Mitchell who was shot. Subsequent coverage confirmed Mitchell's stature with the workers and the public at large. No better strike leader than John Mitchell has ever emerged in any time of industrial strife, reporter Walter Wellman remarked. Throughout the summer, he conducted himself with impressive dignity, never resorting to bitterness or retort. He allowed pumpmen and firemen to continue at work protecting the mines. He agreed to meet with anyone at any time to discuss potential areas of agreement, publicly declaring readiness to compromise. While Mitchell welcomed arbitration, George Baer refused even to meet with the labor leader and flatly denied Mitchell's right to speak for the anthracite miners in the various collieries. To the wealthy, college-educated railroad president, Mitchell was only a common coal miner who had worked with his hands for 15 years and was now a labor agitator. Any negotiations, Baer felt, would unduly recognize a mere rabble-rouser. In response to a citizen's plea for compromise, Baer wrote, "I beg of you not to be discouraged. The rights and interests of the laboring man will be protected and cared for, not by the labor agitators, but by the Christian men to whom God in his infinite wisdom has given the control of the property interests of the country and upon the successful management of which so much depends." When Baer's correspondent submitted this rejoinder to the newspapers, the railroad president's overweening arrogance was mocked in editorials across the country. The doctrine of the divine right of kings was bad enough, but not so intolerable as the doctrine of the divine right of plutocrats, remarked one Boston paper. "It will take a load from the consciences of many earnest people to have this authoritative declaration that God, through the kindness of the coal operators, will be able to manage this strike in accordance with the dictates of infinite wisdom," jeered the New York Tribune. But if the medium's acquaintances really are spirits acquainted with the heavenly mysteries, why, oh why, do they on earth talk such egregious nonsense? In the Northeast, where people suffered the effects of the strike most keenly, opinion began turning against the Republicans, whom many continued to regard as henchmen of the trusts despite Roosevelt's bold action against Northern securities. "The coal business here is getting rapidly worse," Lodge wrote from Massachusetts. "If no settlement is reached, it means political disaster in New England, and especially in this state," Lodge warned. "The demand that the government take the coal fields is rising louder all the time. It is a perilous cry. When the cold weather comes, it will be far worse. You have no power or authority, of course. That is the worst of it. Is there anything you can appear to do?" Roosevelt himself was increasingly frustrated. "I am at my wits' end how to proceed," he admitted. "Of course we have nothing whatever to do with this coal strike and no earthly responsibility for it," he wrote to Hanna. "But the public at large will tend to visit upon our heads responsibility for the shortage in coal, precisely as Kansas and Nebraska visited upon our heads their failure to raise good crops in the arid belt 8, 10, or 12 years ago." In discussions with Attorney General Knox, Roosevelt was told that he had no warrant to intervene. The Constitution provided no precedent for a president to mediate disputes between labor and management. He was warned that he would almost certainly fail if he tried, and that he would injure his prestige and perhaps sacrifice his political future if he essayed to step outside the role of his constitutional duties. Roosevelt would not be confined by precedent, nor bound by fear of failure. He held to what he called the Jackson-Lincoln theory of the presidency. That is, that occasionally great national crises arise which call for immediate and vigorous executive action, and that in such cases it is the duty of the president to act upon the theory that he is the steward of the people, and that the proper attitude for him to take is that he is bound to assume that he has the legal right to do whatever the needs of the people demand, unless the Constitution or the laws explicitly forbid him to do it. On October 1, 1902, he sent identical telegrams to the Coal Operators Board of Directors and to the union representative, John Mitchell. Both factions were invited to Washington to discuss the failure of the coal supply, which has become a matter of vital concern to the whole nation. This singular request from the president captivated newspapermen and magazine writers across the nation. For the first time in the history of the country, Walter Wellman wrote, great corporate leaders and union leaders would join the President of the United States to talk over their differences face to face. The large crowd gathered in front of the temporary White House on Jackson Place earlier that morning was increasing with each passing hour. Confidence spread that an end to the menacing coal strike was near at hand. Reporters eagerly followed the arrival of the parties, contrasting the luxurious private cars that carried the six coal operators to the nation's capital with the smoking car of a night train that transported Mitchell and his three district presidents to Union Station, whereupon they trudged down Pennsylvania Avenue, their grips in their hands, stopping at a cheap hotel. Likewise, the elaborate carriages, staffed by footmen in plum-colored livery that deposited the coal barons at Roosevelt's door, illustrated sharp disparity with the common streetcars that bore the Union representatives from their hotel. Nonetheless, once in the president's presence, both parties met as equals. Theodore Roosevelt greeted his guests warmly, explaining that he could not rise from his chair for his leg was still healing after his recent carriage accident. As the gentlemen took their seats, Roosevelt opened the meeting with a graceful statement acknowledging the existence of three parties affected by the situation in the anthracite trade: the operators, the miners, and the general public. He spoke, he assured them, for neither the operators nor the miners, but for the general public. Rather than adjudicate respective claims, he would appeal to their shared patriotism, to the spirit that sinks personal considerations and makes individual sacrifices for the general good. No sooner had the president finished than Mitchell literally jumped to his feet. In a voice clear as a bell, he reiterated his willingness to negotiate with the operators at any time. If they were unable to reach a resolution by themselves, he would willingly abide by the decision of an impartial tribunal that the president might appoint, even if the ruling denied the miners' claims. Mitchell's dramatic statement took both the operators and the president by surprise. "I had not expected such an offer as this," Roosevelt admitted. Turning to the operators, he asked, "What have you gentlemen to say to this proposition?" After a swift consultation, President George Bear stood up. "We cannot agree to it. We cannot agree to any proposition advanced by Mr. Mitchell," he emphatically asserted. "Very well," said the president. "I shall ask you then to return at 3 o'clock, and I wish you would present at that time your various positions in writing, so we may discuss them." When they reconvened, tension in the room quickly escalated. Rather than engage in open discussion, the coal barons read a series of typewritten statements that accused the strikers of criminal behavior, including the murder of hundreds of non-union men willing to work the mines during the strike. "The duty of the hour is not to waste time negotiating with the fomenters of this anarchy," Bear declared. Roosevelt was stunned by what he considered the extraordinary stupidity and bad temper of the operators, who did everything in their power to goad and irritate Mitchell, resorting to abusive language, insulting to the miners, and offensive to me. Roosevelt told Mark Hanna that after the operators belittled the union officials, "They insulted me for not preserving order by sending federal troops to protect their property, and attacked Knox for not having brought suit against the miners' union as violating the Sherman antitrust law." Through it all, he marveled, Mitchell behaved with great dignity and moderation. Not one of the operators, he remarked, appeared to such advantage as Mitchell, who towered above them all. Roosevelt later admitted that after one operator referred to the union as a set of outlaws, he wanted to take him by the seat of his breeches and nape of the neck and chuck him out that window. With great difficulty, however, he managed to keep his anger in check. Realizing that the operator's high-handed belligerence would negate any direct negotiation, Roosevelt finally repeated Mitchell's proposition that they submit the conflict to a presidential tribunal. Again, they refused to have any dealings of any nature with John Mitchell. Roosevelt was intensely irritated by their stubborn disdain. "If this is the case," he concluded, "I can see no necessity for detaining you gentlemen further." "Well, I have tried and failed," Roosevelt told Mark Hanna. "I feel downhearted over the result, both because of the great misery made necessary for the mass of our people, and because the attitude of the operators will beyond a doubt double the burden on us who stand between them and socialistic action. Worse still, when the coal barons provided an account of the failed conference to the press, they reveled in the fact that they had turned down both the miners and the president." The operators' exultation was short-lived. Roosevelt had made arrangements for a stenographer to record the entire proceedings, and when the statements of both parties were released to the press, public opinion turned sharply against them. While a small number of papers endorsed the operator's view that the public had no rights in the situation and insisted that Roosevelt's uncontrollable penchant for impulsive self-intrusion had made a sorry mess of the negotiations, the majority held the coal barons totally responsible for the failed Washington conference and the continuing strike. Furthermore, their insolent defiance of the president did not compare favorably with Mitchell's respectful, placable, and patriotic spirit. Public condemnation of the operator's intractable behavior fortified Roosevelt as he contemplated a more extreme step. With ugly talk of a general sympathetic strike beginning to spread, he considered the situation nothing short of a state of war. He warned Attorney General Knox and Secretary of War Root that he was considering an action that would form an evil precedent, but felt obliged to take it rather than expose our people to the suffering and chaos which would otherwise come. Knox and Root were free to disavow the action he was contemplating, but he had made up his mind. He believed that the operators and their colleagues on Wall Street were absolutely out of touch with the big world, and the president could not remain idle as misery and death threatened masses of the American people. His undisclosed strategy was to ready a first-rate general and 10,000 regular army troops to enter the coal fields with instructions to dispossess the operators and run the mines as a receiver for the government until a settlement could be reached. He secured the agreement of his selected general, John M. Schofield, to pay no heed to any authority, judicial or otherwise, besides the president in his role as commander-in-chief. According to this stratagem, if the operators went to court and had a writ served on him, he would do as was done under Lincoln, simply send the writ on to the president. This intrepid plan illustrated one of Roosevelt's favorite maxims: don't hit till you have to, but when you do hit, hit hard. Whether the president would have implemented this unorthodox design is not clear. Theodore was a bit of a bluffer, Elihu Root observed. Mark Sullivan, however, had discussed the measure with Roosevelt on a number of occasions and believed Roosevelt was prepared to follow through. The one condition Roosevelt's spirit could not endure, he remarked, was any situation in which individuals or groups seemed able to defy or ignore the people as a whole and their representative in the White House. The question proved moot. Secretary Root devised a way to resolve the issue that would not humiliate the mine owners nor require massive federal intervention. Certain that public opinion had finally convinced the coal barons to negotiate, so long as they did not have to deal directly with union representatives, Root proposed that he travel to New York and meet with J.P. Morgan. If anyone could bring the operators to the table, he believed, it would be the original architect of the Coal Trust. Morgan's financial genius had unified the railway owners and coal men together in the gargantuan combination that now controlled 80% of the anthracite coal market. Root would make it clear that in speaking with Morgan, he acted independently, without instructions from the president. Roosevelt enthusiastically approved the plan. Taking the midnight train to New York, Root met with Morgan for 5 hours on his yacht, the Corsair. Together, they composed a memorandum that Morgan carried to the Union Club, where the mine owners were holding a meeting. The memo called for the president to establish an arbitration commission, virtually identical to the proposition Mitchell and then Roosevelt had suggested at the Washington conference. In this instance, however, J.P. Morgan was advocating the measure, not John Mitchell, allowing the owners to maintain the fiction that they were not negotiating with representatives of organized labor. It was a damned lie, Root later said, but it opened the door to a settlement. To his credit, Morgan intervened at this critical juncture, for only 8 months earlier he had considered Roosevelt's suit against Northern Securities as a personal attack. The financier's willingness to help the president was one of the crowning moments of his life, one journalist remarked, observing, "There was to be no littleness in this great hour." Despite this breakthrough, immediate difficulties emerged regarding the composition of the panel. The owners insisted that the commission be comprised of 5 members chosen from specific categories: an officer of the military or naval engineer corps, an expert mining engineer unconnected with coal, a Pennsylvania judge, a businessman familiar with mining and selling coal, and an eminent sociologist, Both Roosevelt and Mitchell immediately recognized the pointed absence of a labor representative in this configuration. After a series of hurried meetings with Morgan's men, Bacon and Perkins, Roosevelt hit upon a solution. Suddenly he recollected, "It dawned on me that they were not objecting to the thing, but to the name. I found they did not mind my appointing any man, whether he was a labor man or not, so long as he was not appointed as a labor man." Roosevelt promptly appointed E.E. Clark, head of the Brotherhood of Railway Conductors, to the eminent sociologist slot. While the owners would heroically submit to anarchy rather than have Tweedledum, Roosevelt noted with amusement, "Yet if I would call it Tweedledee, they would accept with rapture." Once owners further agreed to expand the commission to include Bishop L. Spaulding of Baltimore, Mitchell brought his miners back to work, peacefully concluding the nation's most serious strike. For 3 months, the commission heard complaints from both sides. The operators presented evidence that strikers had not only threatened but used violence to prevent willing miners from working. The miners spoke of the oppressive hardships of the industry. The commission ultimately awarded the miners a retroactive wage increase of 10%, as well as a reduction in daily work hours from 10 to 9. "The American people will not soon forget their debt to Mr. Roosevelt," the Washington Post editorialized, proclaiming, "More glorious than winning a battle is this triumph of peace." Both Republican and Democratic journals concurred that the strike was won by popular sentiment controlled by the people's chief. Acting as the people's attorney, William Allen White summarized, Roosevelt had defined the public interest in the previously private struggle between labor and capital. Understanding that the laissez-faire philosophy retained powerful appeal, he had patiently waited through 5 months of the strike until the steady pressure of public opinion accompanying the onset of cold weather created space for his unprecedented call to bring the two sides together. And after the failed conference, he wisely allowed outrage over its published transcript to build until the public was primed to sustain radical measures they would have roundly rejected but months earlier. While he was all ready to act if final negotiations failed, Roosevelt was thrilled when a less disruptive solution prevailed. "It is never well to take drastic action," he later commented, "if the result can be achieved with equal efficiency in less drastic fashion." Flush with victory, Roosevelt agreeably shared credit for the successful settlement. "My dear sir," he addressed J.P. Morgan, "if it had not been for your going into the matter, I do not see how the strike could have been settled at this time. I thank you and congratulate you with all my heart." With the coal operators, Roosevelt was less generous. "May heaven preserve me," he told Bammy, "from ever again dealing with so wooden-headed a set." Roosevelt spent November 4, 1902, the day of the midterm elections, at Sagamore Hill. "Mother and I took a walk," he told Kermit, "accompanied by all 6 dogs, whom we both of us feel are real members of the family." And the election results that evening brought an invigorating day to a satisfying conclusion. In early October, when his risky intervention appeared doomed to failure through the obduracy of the capitalists, there was widespread conviction that the new Congress would be overwhelmingly Democratic. But Republicans had defied the midterm curse and retained control of both houses of Congress. Commentators credited the president's successful settlement of the coal strike with saving many thousands of votes. Returning to Washington following the midterms, the president was finally able to move back into the renovated White House. All summer long, Edith had worked with the architects, attending to a steady stream of little problems, sorting through fabric swatches by the dozen, samples of wallpaper and samples of rugs, selecting sofas, tables, and curtains, poring over detailed plans for every bedroom and bath, designing a garden for the children and a tennis court for her husband. The renovations garnered widespread praise. "If Roosevelt had never done anything else," a Washington insider remarked, "the metamorphosis of the White House from a gilded barn to a comfortable residence that he has accomplished would entitle him to his country's gratitude." Roosevelt credited Edith's perseverance and instinct for tasteful comfort. A girlhood marked by relocation from one temporary abode to another as her father's resources diminished had shaped what one historian shrewdly identifies as a remarkable coping mechanism, an ability to make a home on short notice, then pick up her tent and start again. Tasteful comfort. A girlhood marked by relocation from one temporary abode to another as her father's resources diminished had shaped what one historian shrewdly identifies as a remarkable coping mechanism, an ability to make a home on short notice, then pick up her tent and start again. She had reappointed the executive mansion with the same aptitude and flair that had once transformed their tiny rented townhouse in Washington and the cavernous governor's mansion in Albany. Edith never sought recognition for her work. She is an old-fashioned type of woman who feels that no lady should make herself conspicuous, her secretary Isabella Hagner James explained. By nature and inclination, she should probably have had a life of sheltered seclusion, Hagner James later observed in her memoir. But when devotion to her husband necessitated a public presence, never did a woman carry herself with more gentle dignity and charm. She was at home for the cabinet officers' wives every Tuesday morning in the library, entertained hundreds of governmental officials at afternoon teas, and hosted formal dinner parties with uncommon grace. As Jacob Riis understood, however, the chief end of her life lay not in her public duties, but in companionship with husband and children. The president deserved credit for at least one aspect of the new West Wing building. For the first time in history, reporters gratefully noted, the president had set apart a room adjoining his own office for the exclusive use of the press. Formerly crowded together at one end of the general waiting room, journalists now enjoyed immediate access to the president at a room furnished with a large oak table, chairs, and telephones. "The public man who now escapes an interview will have to be a sprinter," one journalist happily remarked. Taking stock of his first 15 months in office, Roosevelt told Maria Longworth Storer in early December that he had achieved as much as he had any right to hope or expect. Though occasionally forced to subordinate his own desires to what was possible under the given conditions, he found comfort in knowledge that Abraham Lincoln had often done the same. With each passing month, the president's hold on the American people grew stronger. "It is very curious," Roosevelt told his newspaper friend, Joseph Buckland Bishop. "Ever since I have been in the presidency, I have been pictured constantly as a huge creature with enormous clenched teeth, a big spiked club, and a belt full of pistols, a blustering, roaring, swashbuckler type of ruffian. And yet all the time, I have been growing in popularity. I don't understand it at all." To Bishop, the reason was perfectly clear. All the cartoonists at heart liked him, and there was seldom or never anything bitter or really unfriendly in their portrayals of him. They were uniformly good-natured. Caricatures even transformed his failure during a mid-November bear hunt into a triumph, conjuring an image of the president steadfastly refusing to shoot a small bear furnished for the occasion. As renditions of the original Clifford Berryman cartoon proliferated, the bear dwindled in size until he appeared as a tiny cub, prompting toy store owners to market stuffed bears in honor of Teddy Roosevelt. Soon, the teddy bear became one of the most cherished toys of all time. Roosevelt's burgeoning public favor augured well for the 1904 presidential race. Although no vice president had ever been elected in his own right after succeeding to the presidency as a consequence of his predecessor's death, "I'd rather be elected to that office than have anything tangible of which I know," he avowed. Nevertheless, he continued to fear that the Republican establishment would prevent his nomination. "They don't want it," he flatly stated. "Hannah and that crowd." Indeed, each time he riled business interests, as with his antitrust suit or intervention in the coal strike, Hannah's name invariably arose. "I do not think Mr. Roosevelt can win," Alabama Senator John Morgan predicted in late November. "I do not believe the wiser heads of the Republican Party want him as the nominee. The trouble is, they cannot keep him where they can rely on him. Every now and then he bucks and runs off. They have to lasso him and haul him back. Newspapers reported that the moneyed interests were determined to prevent his election, even if it meant contributing liberally to the opposition party. Delegations pledged to Mark Hanna were considered especially likely in the South, where Roosevelt's quiet attempt to include blacks in party councils had stirred fierce opposition. In addition, Southern Republicans had never forgiven Roosevelt for the unprecedented dinner invitation extended the previous fall to the black educator Booker T. Washington. At the time, the vehement reaction in the South had stunned and saddened Roosevelt. Newspaper editorials throughout the region decried the president's attempt to make a black man the social equal of a white man by sharing the same dinner table. "Social equality with the Negro means decadence and damnation," announced one Southern official. "The action of President Roosevelt in entertaining that nigger will necessitate our killing 1,000 niggers in the South before they will learn their place," declared South Carolina's Ben Tillman. For disaffected Republicans in the North and South, Mark Hanna promised deliverance from Roosevelt's wrongheadedness. All these factors weighed on Roosevelt's mind as he prepared his second annual address. Delivered on December 2, 1902, the message reiterated his call for Congress to create a Department of Commerce with broad powers of supervision over the big corporations. The tone of his message, not nearly so strong as it was expected to be, proved a great disappointment to reformers. "The plain people," Roosevelt insisted, "are better off than they have ever been before. The majority of the great fortunes were won not by doing evil, but as an incident to action which has benefited the community as a whole. Although abuse and misconduct were undeniable," he urged, "let us not, in fixing our gaze upon the lesser evil, forget the greater good. Those who sought removal of the protective tariff as a punitive measure directed against the trusts," he argued, "put the entire nation's productivity in jeopardy." "It appears that the vested interests of the country have succeeded in scaring the president," one Washington correspondent asserted, "preventing him from expressing in his usual forcible style his convictions." The Cincinnati Enquirer deemed it a very lame message for a president who is chiefly celebrated for his strenuosity, and further lamented that it read like a surrender to the party leaders who control the Senate and House. Other commentators were equally unimpressed. "A milk and water communication," charged the Indiana Democrat, "from a man whose chief aim is the presidential nomination 2 years hence." Even the more moderate reviews were not optimistic that Roosevelt's message heralded any fundamental progress. "We are bound to believe that Mr. Roosevelt's heart is in his policy of regulating the trusts. Yet even here, he is singularly vague and inconclusive," editorialized the New York Evening Post, predicting, "The result of such an uncertain trumpet cannot lead to any serious preparation for battle." In the clamor following the president's message, few perceived that Roosevelt's ideals were always moderated by his pragmatism. Until the Republican establishment felt threatened by an aroused and targeted public opinion, he knew there was little chance of securing legislation to regulate the trusts. His tepid message revealed a conviction that popular outrage was not yet sufficient to threaten the Big Four, those powerful senators who continued to block his path to significant reform. More than any president since Abraham Lincoln, Theodore Roosevelt was able to shrewdly calculate popular sentiment. He read daily excerpts from scores of newspapers, probed the eclectic assemblage of visitors and guests frequenting the White House, and tested his ideas on reporters. Over time, he developed an uncanny ability to gauge the changeable pulse of the American public. His experience in bringing the suit against Northern Securities and mediating the Pennsylvania coal strike had evidenced the signal role the press could play in rallying public support essential to achieve substantial reform. Just as Baker's series on J.P. Morgan's monarchical powers and Crane's descriptions of the inhumane, abusive practices of the coal barons had proven pivotal in alerting the public to the menace of increasingly concentrated monopolies. In order to aggressively pursue redress for the abuses and inequity of the industrial age, the president would need to ride a seismic shift in national consciousness. He would need an instrument capable of reaching into the homes of workers, teachers, shopkeepers, and small business people across the country, an instrument that would not just explain, but vividly illustrate the human and economic costs of unchecked industrial growth and combination. The complex and sometimes contentious partnerships that Roosevelt had forged with investigative journalists would soon illuminate corruption as if by heat lightning and clarify at last a progressive vision for the entire nation.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.